take on Nehemiah. The sheets are in the back. To go with a very brief review of our even briefer introduction that we did last week, we talked about the fact that this book is usually identified classically in our sources as part of the book of Ezra. There aren't two separate books. We talked about that. We noted the major themes that we're going to see within this first chapter are basically an update on the state of the Jews in Jerusalem at this period, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, and we're going to also see Nehemiah's religiosity on display. We talked a little bit about timing slash identity of who Nehemiah is. Specifically, we talked about the question of identifying Nehemiah with Zerubbabel or not. Did he come in earlier? Did he come in later? Going with the chronological read of the book, he's later. Zerubbabel is the beginning. Nehemiah is much later on in our history. But let's move forward from there. So, first of all, in terms of Nehemiah's role, who is Nehemiah? In this story, what's his identity? So he starts out as a key member of the court of a Persian king known to us as Artaxerxes. We've talked about Artaxerxes before. That's the king who sent Ezra in his seventh year. He sent Ezra, this is now the 20th. We noted already that we don't know if it's the same Artaxerxes. We have the idea that Artaxerxes may be an inherited title. It just means king. King, Pharaoh, Abimelech, Artaxerxes, title for the person who is on the throne at the moment. So it's possible this is an entirely different individual. We don't know. What we also don't know about Nehemiah is his lineage. All we get is his father's name is Chachaliah. Okay, Chachaliah is not a familiar name. It's not one of those, like in our list of names that we saw, in which various names repeated and we said those are popular names. We didn't see any Chachaliahs. Both. Chet, Chaf, Lamed, Yud, He. Yes, it is a nightmare for non-Hebrew speakers. Chachaliah, that's all you need. You need a cold in order to be able to pronounce that one. But we really don't know. The Dav Mikra actually floats the idea that Chachaliah is an Egyptian name, which will be very interesting. I mean, there were Jews in Egypt who had fled there after the destruction of the first temple. So, theoretically, it could be someone from that community of Jews who were there. But we don't know. We don't know how it was that Nehemiah ended up in his position in the king's palace. We don't get that kind of information. You know, Daniel, we know all about how he ends up in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. He's a trophy, right? With Nehemiah, we don't know, and he's certainly not in a trophy position, as we're about to see. We don't know how long he held this position, meaning it's the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Has he been doing this for a year? Has he been doing this for 20 years? Did he do it before Artaxerxes came to power? We're not given any information. Contrast that with Ezra, where we got 15 generations of his family line. And through Artaxerxes' testimony about Ezra, we knew something of his role before he made Aliyah. Here we really get nothing. He is the cupbearer, though. So if you would have asked me what it means to be a cupbearer, I would have said, what I suspect most of you would have said, which is, it's not a terribly dignified position. Like, you're the person who, the king wants a drink, they call him and say, bring him some wine, right? That's what I would have assumed the cupbearer was. It's presented actually in Jewish sources as a taster, which puts it even lower, right? He's a taster to make sure it's not poison. In which case, if he managed in that role for 20 years, that would be amazing. That just means the king is really well-liked. So take a look, though, at source number one. I bring you a quote from Dov Zakheim's book. Now, I mentioned this book in the beginning of the year last year when I was talking about other sources you could read to learn more about Ezra and Nehemiah. And I'll take a moment to flesh out some comments on the book. Dov Zakheim was a high up in the U.S. government for a long time, in various governments. And that's the perspective that he brings to it when he writes about Nehemiah. He sees Nehemiah as something of a spiritual ancestor. Here's somebody who's high up in the Persian government, and look at his adventures, and that's the sort of career that I could have in my position in the U.S. government. He's very good at bringing sources, both Jewish and secular, to bear. So he's not afraid to bring in secular and non-Jewish commentaries to Nehemiah in order to make a point. And he's also familiar with the classic Jewish commentaries as well. He uses the Dat Mikra edition. He uses various standard commentaries on the Mikra Ogedolot, Radak, Mitzvot David. There are some mistakes here and there in the book, you know, factual misquotes, that type of thing. But overall, he's good at bringing sources. My only real problem with the book, and I stress it because I think it is an important thing, in, you know, more broadly when you're dealing with contemporary scholarship, is he's an autodidact. He taught himself. It's very clear. Like he may have had courses at some point on secular biblical scholarship, but it looks like he picked a lot of books off the shelf, read through them, understood them, and was able to digest them into what he, you know, into what he provides. Which on the one hand is nice. It's fresh. On the other hand, one of the weaknesses is, and this is what we were just talking about, is that he tends to have his theory of what's going on, and he'll quote whichever side of the sources will support the theory. So on this, Mitzvot David will support his idea. On that, Blenkinsop will support his idea. And that's what he'll bring. I would have preferred a clearer line of approach, like these commentators are based in historical evidence, therefore I adopt them. This is based on association with other books in Tanakh, therefore I support that. He kind of goes back and forth in it. I do think it's a good read. I think it's a worthwhile read, but you have to keep that in mind as you go through it. Yeah. So I'm blanking right now on his roles, but he was deputy chief of something. Like he was fairly high up in it. If I remember, I'll send out later. I did a book review. Oh, you know what? No, I didn't bring it. I was going to say I brought it, but I didn't.
Do you have a Google thing?
I have a phone, but I'm sitting here teaching a class. I'm not about to Google him. No. But I'm going to send out. I'm going to send out later. No one else should do that either.
In this room, I can tell you.
Okay. I'm going to send out later the book review that I did last year for Toronto Torah, and you'll see there a little bit of his background. But he writes, take a look at source number one. He's basing himself on the book of Tobit, which is from the Apocrypha, books that did not make it into Tanakh. It is considered to be a Jewish book. Why it's not in Tanakh, some of the books of the Apocrypha clearly don't make it simply because they're too late in history to be canonized. Some of the books seem to contain elements that are problematic from a Jewish traditional perspective, and maybe that's why they're not in. But take a look at what he says about the position of the cupbearer. The cupbearer to the Persian emperor was an extremely powerful courtier. So he's not, you know, cannon fodder for the poison. Like the biblical Joseph, and for that matter, the Persian cupbearer Achikar, whom the author of the apocryphal book of Tobit describes as, quote, keeper of the royal seal, calculator of the accounts, Nehemiah was virtually a second in command to the emperor. So This is clearly an important position, not a minor position. It's a rotating position, interestingly, which I imagine would be done to prevent anybody from sort of amassing his own his own entourage and support within the court. So you have a few people, and every 2 years it goes to a new person within the circle. Zach Heim was of the opinion that Nehemiah may not have been in his position long. And the reason he says that is because, as we're about to see in the story, a fellow named Hanani comes from Judea with a report about how terrible things are, and if Nehemiah had been in this position for years, they would have come to him before. I'm not so sure that that supposition is correct, because as we're going to see, the Hanani who comes to meet with Nehemiah might be reporting on a recent event, something that had just happened, as we're going to see when we get to the story. Ralph and then Susan.
Well, I just wondered whether the cupbearer has any ritual significance.
Right. Apparently not. This isn't a religious role, and no. Seems not to be. You know, he doesn't even make the bracha for him.
It's not like a cardinal.
No. Not that I've seen. Yes, Susan.
Well, if you say it's a rotating position, he couldn't have had it for a long time,
right?
Because I mean, that would make it would contradict.
No, not necessarily. If it's a rotating position and he's within a group and they take turns every 2 years.
Oh, so he gets back again.
Yeah, and he's always going to be high up, meaning the people who have this rotation are not, you know, now you're the cupbearer and now you're, you know, you watch the door in the back of the palace.
I sort of thought you were nothing after you came back in.
Right, I don't think you can really do that. In the Israeli government, they do that. Right? One day you're Minister of Defense, and then, you know, you lose favor with the Prime Minister or whatever it is, and now you're a nothing, and then we'll pull up somebody else. Yeah, but generally speaking, that's not the way governments do things.
Okay. Yeah. We're compared to the Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And the Joseph story.
Yeah.
That was a major figure in the government.
Yes. Yes.
Same deal.
So it would appear. So, we know he's the cupbearer. We know it's an important position, and really Joseph is our best biblical analogy. Joseph and Mordecai, you know, at the end of Esther, are really the only other ones biblically to hold this kind of a position in a foreign government. Daniel, actually, I should say, also. Daniel is a fair example also. We get no genealogy, as you mentioned, in introducing him other than this Chachalia, which may mean he's a nobody. It could mean that he's not an aristocrat, member of the Judean royal line. But then the question is, why is he in this position? Maybe merit. I don't know. He doesn't say. It could be that he didn't deem it worth recording. But that's strange as well. Because, first of all, we saw Ezra get his whole family recorded, right? Number one. But number two, Nehemiah is going to be criticized, we're going to see later on, for playing himself up in the course of this book. For describing himself as the sort of the savior. And so, if so, I would have expected, unless he's going to describe himself as a self-made person, I would have expected he'd tell us all about his lineage and his family and how wonderful they were. It's a strange thing.
Well, he has to build himself up because he has to know his lineage.
Maybe that's why maybe he's compensating.
Yes.
Could be. Yes, Alicia.
Unless it could have been edited out, do you see? If he builds himself up and can see the other the embarrassment of this guy, the son of all these
right.
people, so maybe he would
take him down a peg? So the problem, it's an interesting idea. The problem is then there were other things they should have taken out, as we're going to see shortly. Like, he takes credit for things, like, that's what I would have taken out. The line about how wonderful I am, look what I did for the Jewish people, as opposed to my great-grandfather was so-and-so. No. In lineage? Oh, you mean in terms of praising herself? Yes, and she gets taken down a peg for it in the commentaries for doing so. Correct. Ad shakamti devora, right? Until I came, then things got better. Correct. Yes. That's not so. The men get it also, as we're about to see. Sorry?
Was this written by Nehemiah? Was it
yes.
By
yes. So I think we said at the end last week, the assumption is that Nehemiah is actually the writer, and you see it's in first person. It's presented as him speaking.
Why would it not be? Why is it a Christian invention to have a separate book? I mean, do you ever have like someone writing his?
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's not usually this large a section, but Yehoshua, right, at the end of the book describes the events from after his death, and it's very clear it's not being written, but although he's not credited with writing the first part, so maybe that's what you mean. In other words, Ezra is credited with writing the first part. No, I think their breakup of it into two books is logical, but it just wasn't done. We never did it. It was describing, keep in mind, Ezra only showed up in chapter 7 of the book of Ezra, and he is going to be an actor throughout Nehemiah. So it will be kind of odd to have the book of Ezra with 10 chapters of which he shows up for 4, right? And then the book of Nehemiah in which he has more activity than he had in the book of Ezra. So this really was the book of Ezra, even if it was authored by Ezra and then Nehemiah. Yeah?
Okay, I'm reading the commentary here. And it says that Nehemiah was a decade after Ezra.
Yeah.
Do we have any?
Yeah, no, we talked about this. We said that Ezra showed up in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes and Nehemiah in the 20th. Right? And then we had the discussion right in the beginning today. We don't know if it's the same Artaxerxes, but yeah, no, that's what they're drawing on. So the in terms of what he ends up doing, he becomes a leader in building up the walls of Yerushalayim. As a matter of fact, for those who have seen Zechariah, Zechariah has a vision at one point of a stone with seven eyes on it. And commentators take it as representing seven leaders. And one of those seven leaders is Nehemiah. He becomes involved in religious leadership as well, alongside Ezra. And he makes many enemies. And here we get something which we saw way, way back in Eov, in Job. If you flip your Tanakh for a second to Job chapter 38, it is page 6071 won't really help you here. Here you need the Hebrew. And they actually show it to you. The end of it's in the middle of the page on 1670. If you go to the end of the line, you see there are two words on consecutive lines in which the ayin is suspended in the air. Each time, the word sounds like it is rishaim, which means wicked people. But if you take out the ayin, it is rashim, which means people who are
poor
people who are impoverished. If you now jump into the English translation, you'll see what it says. Sentences 13 and 14. This is part of God's lecture of Job. Right? You want to tell me how to run the universe, maybe you should get some work experience. So he says, starting in 12, because I guess that's really where the line begins. Did you ever in your life command the morning or teach the dawn its place? To grasp the edges of the earth and shake the wicked from it. As it changes itself, as a seal does to clay, as people come into being like the earth's garment, as light is withheld from the wicked, that's the second appearance of the word wicked, and their raised arm is broken. So that's the line. And it's about the withholding of light from the wicked, the shaking of the wicked from the world. Clear? This is an incredibly dramatic passage. So take a look now at source number 2, please. And what the Talmud has to say about that passage. Obviously, the sages are going to notice when there's a letter ayin that's floating above the line. That's not something we see, I think, anywhere else. So, mitnema ayin shel rishayim tsluya. Why is the letter ayin of the word rishayim suspended? Why is it in midair? Kevan shenasa adam rush milamata, nasa rush milamala. And the answer is that what this text is trying to say is when someone becomes rush meaning poor in the sense that he has enemies here in this world, then that's a sign that he has enemies up in the heavens. If people don't like you, it's a sign that God doesn't like you. Oh boy. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that talks about the spirit of people.
If you're poor, like it's really a punishment?
No, it's not about poverty.
No,
it's a statement of if a person has enemies down here, if they're besieged by enemies down here, they're also besieged by enemies upstairs. That's the idea. So it says Rishaim, but it also says Rashim. Right, so that's what I'm saying. Here, the idea of being poor is the idea of having enemies. That's really the idea in this context. Yeah, besieged by enemies is the way it's usually taken. So then they ask, if you want to say the person is rush here and up in the heavens, if you want to say a person who has enemies, God doesn't like them also, then what's the letter ayin doing there at all? Why is there an ayin? It's not about being wicked. It's about being somebody who has enemies. So the answer of Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar answer that there were two figures in Jewish leadership who had many enemies, but it wasn't because they were wicked people. One was King David, and the other was Nehemiah. And lest people read this and interpret that the that must be Nehemiah is a bad guy because he had enemies, therefore we sort of insert the ayin to read the line as those who are wicked, not those who are surrounded by foes. If you take a look at number two, you see I brought you the Gemara, I brought you Rashi. And Rashi says, he had many Jewish enemies who sought to kill him for building the temple. He, Nehemiah, had enemies who were upset. What business do you have building up the temple? Meaning, who is going to be angry about that? The Samaritans, right? The nations around us. Alternatively, there were many Jewish zealots. And that's why the ayin is there to say that this comment about people with enemies is not actually about, it's not about righteous people, it's about wicked people. Don't read this as being about righteous people. If righteous people have enemies, it's because of it's the enemy's fault. If wicked people have enemies, it's because they're bad. This way we have saved the honor of Nehemiah. But the reason why I quote this is to show you the Talmudic recognition, and we're going to see it in the text, that he wasn't the most popular leader we ever had. There were issues there. Jeanine.
I'm a little bit off the track, but how does if you say that, how does the end of that saying go? Naser Rosh Milmala. That sounds like a punishment, or he's not looked at. If it's not his fault, and it's wicked people that hated him, why should...
Right, then he won't be. This isn't referring to him. It's only referring to wicked people. In other words, if he's a good guy and he has enemies, that's not a function of God's attitude to this person. It's only if he earned it by being bad, that's when it's a reflection of God. Either way, it's not a punishment. What they're suggesting is really no different from what you see in a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, "Kol sheruach habrios nocha imenu, ruach hamakom nocha imenu." If people like somebody, God likes them. What in the world is that about? So generally we understand that it's a statement that God wants people to get along with others. He's not looking for a person to offend the world. That's the general understanding of what that passage is about in Pirkei Avos. And the same idea here. So in the event that someone has enemies and is a function of his wickedness, then you should know it's probably also God is not happy with him either. But on the other end, if he's a good guy, then the fact that there are people who hate him because he's doing good things doesn't mean that God is upset with him also. In the end, what we've done is we've neutralized the line, and in the process, what we've done is we've taken it away from having any meaning whatsoever. Right? Because now you can always just interpret it however you like. Right? If you have enemies, it's probably because you're a good guy and they're bad. That would be my assumption. It must be, right? It's not my fault.
What philosophical called out of the whirlwind on these last chapters revealed by Robert Alter in Communism years ago.
Oh yes. Now this just demands poetic commentary and yes. Okay. So Nehemiah's methods. So we're going to see his relationship with God front and center in this chapter, but over the course of the book, we're going to get to see him much more as a get-things-done type of a leader. He is entirely selfless, as he makes sure to tell you. If you jump ahead to chapter 5 for a second, we're on page 1847. Verses 14 to 19. He says, "Moreover, from the day the king appointed me as governor of the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, I and my brethren did not eat of the governor's food. The former governors who were before me had imposed burdens on the people, took bread and wine from them, 40 silver shekel, their servants domineered over the people, but I did not do so because of my fear of God. And also I supported the work of this wall, we didn't buy any field, all of my servants were gathered there for work. I didn't request the governor's food, for the labor weighed heavily upon the people. So I was selfless, and I'm going to make sure that you know it." That's the language that he presents in the book, which leads us to source number 3, which I've already alluded to. Source number 3 on your sheet, also from the Talmud towards the end of Sanhedrin. The Gemara asks a question, which sort of goes back to Janine's question: why not make this a separate book? But the way that they ask it is, why isn't this called the Book of Nehemiah? If, after all, he wrote the majority of the book, right? If you take the book and look at the majority of it, it's Nehemiah writing. Michti komili de Ezra Nehemiah ben Chachalia Amrinu. Nehemiah is the one who recorded Ezra's deeds. Nehemiah ben Chachalia, my time alo ikri sifra al shmei. So why isn't the book named for him? So Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba says, "Mipnei shehechzik tov alatzmo," because he took credit for himself. The sages did not like the idea of somebody tooting his own horn, male or female. Shenamar, and they quote the pasuk here, "Zachra li Elokai litova." God, this was the last passage that we actually it's the verse after what we read in chapter 5. The last sentence of chapter 5, he says, "God, you should remember me for the good, for everything that I did for this nation." Rabbi Yosef, gave a different reason. Because he spoke in a derogatory way about those who preceded him. Right? The governors who preceded me, they took from everybody, they levied their taxes, and their servants dominated the people. So he degraded his predecessors. And Va'afa Daniel Shagabu Menasipir, he even degraded Daniel, who was greater than he was, and how dare he? Don't mess with Daniel. So the Gemara praises him for taking his own credit. Zakkai made the same point in source number 4 when he noted something interesting about this book. The fact that he mentions no intermediary. In fact, throughout his memoir, he never mentions having consulted any powerful ally or even assistant before deciding upon a policy or course of action. Indicates that from the very start, he was determined to receive all the credit for any actions he might take on behalf of his people. In this regard, now Zakkai gives you his own take. This is his political take. In this regard, he acted no differently than any other politician of any era. Yet the very fact that he did so in his memoir testifies to its authenticity. Memoirs invariably serve to glorify their authors. Of course, it is for this very reason that the sages rebuked him. So Zakkai sees it as a negative. But I have to show you that there's another way to read this. We've already pointed out that Nehemiah has enemies. He has enemies who are outside of the Jewish people, who don't like what he's doing in his role as a leader. And he has enemies from within the Jewish people who are perhaps jealous of the power that he wields and the things he's able to do. And so if you take a look at source number 5, Professor Moshe Tzvi Siegel in Encyclopedia Mikra'it says, "Efshar shechiburo no'ad l'shamesh ketav magen neged oivav harabim." He says, this composition, meaning the book, might have been meant to serve as a defense against his many enemies. He's justifying his actions. And that's why you see his customary prayer in this composition. He keeps saying, "God, remember me for the good," like the last sentence in chapter 5. And remember for the worst, the bad deeds of the enemies. So in other words, it's possible that Nehemiah feels a need to justify himself in the book. And this, you know, Zakkai may be right that the goal of memoirs is to glorify the person writing it. But I think it's also to defend against all of the different allegations. I'm going to set the record straight. Here's what really happened. And then I'll go on to present my perspective. Follow? Yeah.
Doesn't that negate what we had said in three, why he wasn't given the name of Nehemiah? Like, then why, if we take what we just said now, then we can't take the other.
Right. So I think you could harmonize the two. I don't have to. Meaning you could be right. It could be that there are two different ways to look at what he did. Or it could be that Talmud recognizes his justification and says it's still wrong. You know, justifying yourself in Tanakh maybe isn't the best way to go. That's possible. But I want to note one point that I think you can't really miss here. Look at the top of the page, on page 18. Well, we're on 1849, 1847 right now, but it really doesn't matter. Go back to the beginning of Nehemiah on page 1837. What does it say in big bold letters in the margin on page 1837, right before verse 1? It says Nehemiah, right?
Right.
And that's the way we've been doing it for a long time, right? Centuries. We've been saying the book of Nehemiah. The Talmud says he doesn't get his name on the book. Yeah, except he does. So the Chidah, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in source number 6, says he already had his kapara. He had his atonement. He says, "V'zeh kama me'os shanim." It's already centuries. Behigalos niglos hadefus ba'olam since the revelation of the printing press. Ma depes ve'ole sefer Nehemiah l'chud. That's a pun. The word ma depes is to print. Mat pace ve'ole is to climb. Mat pace with a tet. Right, with a tet. So it's a pun, Madhapes Ve'ole. But his point is that the book of Nehemiah is what everybody calls it. And he brings you two explanations for why. His first explanation I skipped because I can't really explain it. It's a Kabbalistic explanation related to Gilgul and all sorts of very interesting stuff about reincarnation and who was reincarnation of whom. And I just don't understand it, so I wasn't about to try. But then he writes, "Vod Efshar Lomer." You could say, "Demasha Amar Zochrali Elokai LaTova Inami B'Mesha Siper B'Gnusan Shal Rishayim Barov Hayamim Niskaper." His sins, right? Saying, "Remember me, God, for the good," or insulting the people who came before him. Okay, but over time, it's forgiven. He atoned already. It's bad enough. He went for a long time without getting credit for his book. You know, let him back in at this point. And he concludes, Ve'eino mikre chas v'shalom. He says, this is not happenstance that we call it Nehemiah. Don't make a mistake of saying, okay, so I guess it just changed. He says, Hakol b'dikduk gamur. Everything is precise. Reward and punishment is precise. And therefore, there was a period of time when he didn't have his name on it, and now he gets to have his name on it. That's the view that the Chidah, Rabbi Azulai, brings. Okay, so that's just background. Now we have the background. Let's actually plunge into the book. So let's take a look at the opening four psukim, the opening four sentences. Again, if you're in the Stone Tanakh, you're on page 1837. Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia. Vayihi v'chodesh kislev shnas esrim, v'ani ayisi b'shushan habira.